Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to season 2 of the Modern Adventurer podcast. I'm your host, John Horsfall. I'm an adventurer and photographer, and each week I'll be talking with a new guest about their latest adventure from around the world. For all the new listeners and subscribers who have joined, I speak to adventurers and explorers who do remarkable things in the field of exploration and endurance. This is an immersive podcast, so this season their story is cut to music and cinematic effects as we immerse ourselves into the heart of their adventure. My next guest is an army officer, physiotherapist, and endurance athlete. She became the first person to reach the South Pole on foot in 2 years, completing the trek in little over 40 days. She conquered temperatures of minus 50 and winds of up to 60 while pulling a 90-kilo sledge. Nonetheless, she completed her 700-mile challenge almost a week ahead of schedule, skiing from Hercules Inlet to the South Pole in 40 days, 7 hours and 3 minutes. She hopes her achievement will inspire others, writing, "This expedition was always about so much more than me. I want to encourage people to push their boundaries and to believe in themselves, and I want to be able to do it without being labeled a rebel." She is an inspiration and role model as the first woman of color to complete this impressive feat. She said, "No matter where you're from or where the start line is, everybody starts somewhere. I don't want to just break the glass ceiling. I want to smash it into a million pieces." I'm delighted to introduce Preet Chandri, aka Polar Preet, to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
What I love to do at the sort of beginning of the podcast for people who don't know you, who are you, what do you do, and how did you get into this sort of life of adventures?
Yeah, of course. So my name is Preet Chandri, and I'm a physiotherapist in the British Army. And how did I get into a life adventure? Oh, wow. Good question. For me, I think the more we do, the more we realize we're capable of. And I realized that at probably around my 20s that I liked distance running, and I started to do a little bit more and a little bit more. And for a while, I knew I wanted to do something big. I just didn't know what it was. I don't think I'm the strongest or the quickest, but I do like to keep going. So I thought it's going to be something long. And it was my old boss that, you know, we were brainstorming and I mentioned that I wanted to do something big. And he said, "What about Antarctica?" And I thought, not a chance. I don't know anything about Antarctica at all. You know, I have never been in those kind of conditions. And then the idea came back to me. And, you know, I thought, why not? How amazing would it be to go and do something that I don't know anything about, and to show, actually, we can come from any sort of background. And, you know, it's okay that I didn't grow up reading about polar explorers. So that's how I kind of got into this, which I love. I love that I didn't really know anything about it. And, you know, I started on Google, as you do. So that was my starting into this.
I think it's sort of terrifying when you have an idea in your head and it just grows and grows yes. and grows on you. And then suddenly it sort of consumes everything about you. When you have these yeah. sort of things, you sort of at night, you go to bed sort of dreaming about it, thinking of it so much, and it sort of just takes hold. But you, even beforehand, were doing these sort of adventures. You had done the sort of Marathon de Sable. You were a very competitive sports person.
Yeah, so I played tennis when I was younger. So I started when I was 10 and started playing, I think, competitively quite quickly. I moved away from home when I was 14 and then lived in like a tennis house with a guardian for a short time, and then 16 to Czech Republic. And then I moved back to England when I was 19. So I didn't really do kind of the usual education. I only did a few GCSEs. I didn't do A levels. And for a long time, it wasn't really something I enjoyed. And I wanted to come back. And it's funny, I think you always crave what you don't feel like you have. And for me, I was craving some sort of stability. And, you know, I remember really keen to get into university and thought I was so far behind everybody else my age. I was 19 thinking, God, you know, I'm not smart enough. And again, other people told me as well that I wasn't smart enough and I wouldn't be able to get into university, which is one of my biggest achievements to date. And it's hard to do things when either you don't believe in yourself or other people have told you that you can't do something. And I stopped playing tennis for a long while, really, and then tried to pick it up again a little bit through different teams. And I think from there, I wanted something that I felt was something that I enjoyed, that I wanted to do. And it was at university, I decided to do a half marathon. And then after doing the half marathon, I decided to do a full marathon. And it was after university that I ran my first ultra marathon, which went terribly wrong. I mean, I finished, but I felt horrible at the end. I was so unprepared for everything. But then, you know, it almost caught that bug. And I joined the army when I was 19, when I came back from Czech Republic, because I saw an advert in Derby City Centre. Didn't tell anybody in my family. And when I did tell people weren't very happy. But again, when you were doing things that are considered out of the norm, I think they're often questioned. And it opened up a different world for me. So yes, I did play sport, but the kind of the outdoor world, you know, like the adventure type. So I hadn't been like done really walking outside or like been camping. And, you know, the first time I properly went, I don't know, you can't really call it camping, but did that kind of thing was in the army. So that opened up different doors. And I found the more that I was doing within the army, the more I started doing in my civilian side as well. And after that ultra marathon, then, you know, I remember reading about Marathon des Sables, so this kind of ultra marathon in the Sahara Desert, in a book that I got for Secret Santa. And the title was something along the lines of The World's Toughest Challenges. And when I first read about it, I was like, whoa, that sounds, you know, like insane, amazing, and all those things. And a few years later, I thought, well, why not just enter it? And I did. And in my mind, I had this thing. It was like, if I can do that, if I can complete this, then I can go on and do this big thing. That's Antarctica. And yes, they're in completely different climates, but it's it's another barrier, isn't it? It's this big thing that I read about years ago, and they're all achievable. And I'm not going to say they're easy. Like, it was hard to get to Antarctica. It really was. But they are achievable.
I think it's we had Jamie Ramsey, who on the podcast on episode 4, and he sort of described it as blowing up a balloon. You sort of blow up the balloon and it sort of gets to this stage and you're like, oh, okay. And then you blow a bit more and gradually it gets bigger and bigger, and sort of what you're capable of, it just sort of grows and grows and grows.
Yes. Yeah, 100%.
And so with the Antarctica, was that before? Did the idea sort of come to you before you started doing these sort of challenges of Marathon des Sables, or was it like Marathon des Sables, all right, what's next?
No, I had Antarctica as a really vague idea at the back of my head, but I had to do Marathon des Sables before I would start preparing or looking into it. And that was just in my head. If I can do this, I can do MDS. I can start preparing or planning or finding out what I even do, you know, to the point I was like, do you run? Do you ski? So, you know, how do I go there and what do I do there? So yes, I had it as an idea before, and then you know, I was supposed to be like super prepared for going to Sahara Desert, but I entered and then I ended up going on a tour to South Sudan with the army. So I spent 6 months there. And then I had some leave when I came back. So I decided to go traveling around South America, just like kind of sprain my ankle, nothing too big, but on one of the kind of walks there. And then came back to England with about a week to pack, to get my kit ready for this race and buy all my food and stuff. So I was definitely not prepared, not as prepared as I should have and could have been. But, you know, it was great. And I was there on my own, but you're not alone in these events. There are so many other people there with you. I shared a tent with some amazing people who I'm still in touch with to this day. So, yeah, really, it was a really great event.
Well, I think South Sudan is probably better training than sort of up and down Hyde Park in London, where there's a bit of sand.
Yeah, but the thing is, with the because of the temperature out there, we can't go out and train as it gets above a certain temperature. So to be honest, I didn't really do much. I did a little bit of like endurance type stuff. I did, you know, I was keeping fit and in the gym and stuff, but not really going out and running too much. Apart from one event that I decided to organize, which probably part of my training, but I said to everyone, let's do an endurance event, you know, for charity while we're out here. And we did it overnight because, you know, we were able to do it then. And I decided to do 12 hours on one camp that we had. So I did the whole 12 and others would come and join me for like an hour overnight. And then I thought, well, if I'm doing one camp, I might as well do the other camp too. So I'll make it 24 hours, you know, I'll do this one camp and then the week later I flew to the other camp, did another, and I thought, if I'm doing 24 hours, I might as well include the transit camp, so I'll make it 30 hours. So over like a week and a half I did so I guess that was training, this 30 hours this kind of walk slash slow jog around these different camps in South Sudan for charity, which was good fun.
Wow. So you got back, and so this idea of Antarctica grew on you as you sort of stepped up on these sort of challenges, but you had no sort of experience in the cold, and so the probable training through that sort of towards Norway and Greenland.
Yeah,
and that's sort of what you did. So in terms of from the idea to getting out there, what was the sort of planning and execution to achieve? Yeah, because getting out there is probably almost the hardest.
Yes,
part.
Yeah, it was. So I so looking online, I found Antarctic logistics and expeditions quite soon, and filled out this kind of this questionnaire, and then they contacted me and gave me kind of a list of things that I needed to do. You know, had I been camping on snow? Had I done these trips? They suggested doing like a polar training course, and I did a course in February 2019. Hannah McKean's polar expedition training. So, you know, perfect course to do. And that was a great course. And it gave me a really good baseline, which is what I wanted. You know, I realized as well when I went there that I wasn't starting, you know, as a complete beginner like I thought I was. So I realized that, okay, I might have not put up a tent in the snow before, but I have put up a tent, you know. I did know how to work as a team, you know, in the like your team we were in. I knew how to use a compass and navigate. Do you know what I mean? I realized that actually there were these crossover skills that I had that you know were helping me in this training course, and that gave me such a good baseline to then move forward. And it wasn't very long after getting back from there it was then COVID. Then I'm in a medical regiment in the army, so you know we were on kind of notice to move, and to get to Greenland that was my toughest training trip by far. So it just opened up for that we could travel again around August time. Oh, I said 2019 for the last one, but I think it might have been, trying to figure out what year I'm in now. I went in August to Greenland, and they'd cancelled all the expeditions that year. And I was desperate to go because I knew I wanted to get to Antarctica. And I knew I wanted to get to Antarctica. And I emailed all the companies and asked if they could find me a guide. And one of the companies did find me a guide. So like the week before, I was like running around the UK, borrowing equipment from everybody I could. I couldn't afford the trip all in one go. So I paid, instead of buying the house, or that I was supposed to, I used my house savings and life savings to go to Greenland. And it still wasn't enough. So we then agreed that I'd pay it off in 7-month installments. And you know, we got out to Greenland and then quarantine. It was like 3 flights, a helicopter and a boat to get us to our start point. We had some pretty tough weather out there, kind of every 3 days after we got over the crevasse fields. It was like a storm hit. So we were having to kind of like, you know, stay in the tent in those days. And then the last 5-6 days, we got stuck in a storm and had to stay in the tent. Anyway, we weren't going to make the full crossing and had to be extracted off the ice. So there was this trip, and I remember there were some low moments there for me. I was in this tent on this trip, having used everything I had, and I hadn't reached the other side, which, you know, I kind of expected I would have done. And then we had to be extracted off the ice. And I remember them asking me on the satellite phone how I was going to pay. And that's probably one of the most stressful situations or conversations I've had to have, because I didn't know. I literally, you know, I'd used everything. And eventually the company that found me, the guide, they paid. And I couldn't afford to pay them back for a year and a half, or just under a year and a half. I paid them off just before I went to Antarctica. And came back, and then we got off the ice and our kit, which was supposed to be on that side, we got off the ice and then our flight was cancelled, of course, and then we finally got on the internal flight to the other side of Greenland, where our kit was supposed to be, other clothing, which of course wasn't there, had been sent back. And it was almost like everything that could go wrong was going wrong. So finally made it back to the UK, still in my ski boots, you know, other clothes were still in Greenland, and I felt deflated. I felt mentally and physically deflated. I'd used all, you know, everything I had. I owed so much money. And I remember I was supposed to be doing the virtual London Marathon the next day. And I remember my partner saying to me, you know, you don't have to do it. And I don't know what it was in my mind that I think it was just to prove to myself that when I'm feeling like this, I can give more. So I didn't have my trainers. They were in Greenland. So I used my military boots and walked/hobbled the London Marathon virtually. It took me over, I think it was like 7.5 hours. So that was a long day. That trip I talk about a lot when I talk about Antarctica, because it gave me so much. It was like the best failure that I've ever had. And I didn't see it straight away. I think it's really hard, you know, when you have that, to straight away be like, yeah, I'm going to learn so much from this. That's not true. I felt horrible after, you know, it wasn't a great feeling. And I learned all the things that I personally needed to work on as well. And I learned so much from it. You know, I really did. And I used to think about it when I was in Antarctica. I think, well, at least I'm not stuck in a storm for 6 days, you know? So those tough times that you have, I think we can use them. I really did. I did do a bit more training after that, but that was one of the key trips for me. I think that I learned so, so much from. So we spent 27 days on the ice cap. And yeah, it was a really good learning trip. And I realized I said 2019 for Norway. I think I meant 2020 when I did that training trip.
Good. So after Greenland, you'd had this sort of failure. And so sort of almost rock bottom was the sort of foundations to sort of build yourself up to go towards Antarctica.
Yeah, it was a tough time. It was, you know, I didn't have any sponsors on board at the time. So I was using everything I had. I was doing my master's at the time as well, which I didn't manage to get funding for. So that as well. With COVID, we were on notice to move. I didn't start vaccinating until the year after being one of the vaccinators. But it was a tough time, I found personally. And, you know, I was emailing 10, 15 companies a night, and I wasn't getting much back. And obviously it was COVID as well. So when they did respond, it was, you know, sorry, we've got this huge pandemic going on. So there were so many other things going on that made it tough. And in the background, I was really determined. I just wanted to keep going. And in those tough moments and times, I just took it one thing at a time. So, okay, you know, at least I had gone to Greenland. It took me a while to realize like what I'd learned from it and, you know, what I could use moving forward. And, you know, I realise now looking back, like, I'm really glad it wasn't just a smooth crossing with good weather. Would I have learnt the things I learnt from it? Probably not. And it's hard to see that it is, you know, and I think definitely at the time. But I'm glad it went the way it did. I don't look back now and think, I mean, it was a difficult trip, but, you know, I look back at it, I'm like, well, it was difficult, but I also did it. And I think a lot of us have, you know, some tough times, tough moments, and we don't give ourselves enough credit for getting through those times as well. And I think we should, you know, we literally have got through that time. Whereas a lot of the time, I think we can be quite mean to ourselves. I certainly can. And then I think, well, I'd never talk to my friend that way. So why do I talk to myself this way?
And so what was the sort of turning point? Because it sort of sounds like the time between Greenland and Antarctica was pretty tough, because to get out there, you need big sponsors.
Yeah.
You were sending 15 odd a night, getting nothing back. What was the sort of turning point which went from this is never going to happen to, oh, this is happening?
Yeah. So so my first sponsor came on board 10, 11 months before I left. And I like, it's so great to see the emails come through, because I went through the inquiry page on their website. And, you know, when they responded, it obviously gone forward, you know, like to the people. And then I did the pitch. So I did the pitch in December, and then they kind of came on board like Jan, Feb time before. And I found when I got that first sponsor, well, one, it gave me confidence. Like, you know, I literally have a company backing me. And then I got more sponsors on board. You know, I feel like having that first sponsor, really helped. Like, and I think it gave me a bit more life as well to like push a bit more. Okay, like be a bit smarter about where I'm going. I started using LinkedIn quite a lot, to be honest, and started messaging like anybody I could on LinkedIn, and got some more sponsors on board. And I mean, to be honest, without those sponsors, you know, I wouldn't have been able to go to Antarctica. I couldn't, like, I used everything I had already. So I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. So it's so great to like have them on board. And it's great to have people that support you before you've gone and done the thing, because that's when it's hard, right? That's when people are taking the risk. Whereas when I've come back, there's so many people who are like, yeah, you know, we were supportive all along. And that's not really the reality. When I had this idea, and, you know, the lead up, there are a lot of people who just weren't very interested. And that's not me saying, oh, you know, you weren't interested, you know, you don't get to be supportive now. That's not what I mean by that. But what I mean, or what I want to kind of say, is it's great that I'm here now, but when the next person comes along and they, you know, have this idea, this dream, whatever it is, ambition, let's support that person. Let's encourage people to push their boundaries, just because we are wanting to do something that's different from the norm. You know, that shouldn't be discouraged. And I found that quite a lot. You know, a lot of the time people would say to me, why can't you just be normal almost like a bit of a joke, but, you know, because I'm doing all these things that weren't their normal. It's not the expected thing. Why can't I just do the expected thing? And I want pushing our boundaries to be the normal thing, because we create our own normal, right? And that could be whatever we want it to be.
I think you learn a lot more about oneself and the world by doing that, getting out there, discovering, whether it's about yourself, about how far you can push yourself.
Exactly.
In that respect. Well, sort of let's jump into the story. So you've got these sponsors, you're now a couple of days before you're about to sort of start your journey. What are the sort of feelings going through your head as you are flying to probably Chile?
Yes, yeah. So flying to Chile, I felt a bit more relaxed then. The few days before I was flying to Chile, it's quite stressful, I found, or that few weeks. But then I'm on the plane, you know, I'm on the way there. Which is great. And I'm flying to Chile. I had a stop in Amsterdam for kind of 45 minutes, you know, but I got there in plenty of time to walk to the next gate. And I've got my black rucksack, which has got all my satellite comms equipment in, my laptop. And I go to get something out of my bag and realize I picked up the wrong rucksack. And I honestly, the sudden panic that hit me. So then I suddenly start running back to the gate that I think I came out of, because nobody ever, you know, remembers the gate that they came from. And I think I was running probably like 3-4 minutes, and then somebody shouted, and it was the air crew on the other side with somebody who'd picked my bag up, and oh my god, thank god they'd noticed. And then we swapped bags, and he went to get his transit flight somewhere else, and then I went to get mine, and I'm just like, oh, I remember messaging to my family, and they were just like, only you, Preet. And I was like, I know. I was like, only me. So after that, I was just, you know, holding onto my bag like super tightly, and went to Santiago, had a COVID test, stayed there the night, and then flew to Punta Arenas. And then it was prep phase, pretty much. I'd given myself more than enough time to do that phase, because I was worried that I'd get stuck with COVID. And then I prepped everything. I prepped all of my food. I took all of the food out of its original packaging. I chopped everything down into small pieces. I wrote messages on every single food bag, because I wanted this to be about more than me. I was bringing all these people with me. I hadn't met them, but there were people that had written on LinkedIn or Facebook or social media. And I wrote their names on the messages as well. So I had that with me kind of every day. And then flew to Antarctica, to Union Glacier. And to be honest, getting there, like, I mean, it's amazing, right, to be in Antarctica. But I was very much focused on getting started. So this is, I mean, getting to Antarctica was a huge achievement for me. You know, I actually made it there to go and do this expedition. And there weren't many of us doing solo expeditions. You know, it was tough to get there. It really was. And I remember when I stayed in Union Glacier for about 2 days before I flew to my start point at Hercules Inlet. And that's the moment I was kind of on my own, and, you know, like watched a twin otter fly away, and that's me. And I was ready to go. You know, I was excited to kind of get going. This is something, like I said, you know, 2.5 years of planning to get started.
So at the start, what was sort of one of the problems that you faced?
So in terms of problems at start, so it, I mean, the sled's at its heaviest, then, so, it's, you know, you can kind of feel it as you're dragging it, and you start on like a steeper section. But to be honest with you, I felt fresh, you know, so even, yes, it's a heavy sled, I felt fresh, and I knew that I was expecting that. So there weren't, you know, surprises there. Probably the size of some of the sastrugi, which are like those wind-shaped ridges, some of them, they were huge. But that was a little bit later in the trip. And there were the sections were mixed. So some sections, it felt like, you know, it was really dragging hard behind me. And there were a few sections that it was a bit icier. I probably fell over more times than I thought I would. And I did think to myself, I thought, oh, I wonder if there's like a Guinness World Record for this amount of times you fall over on a trip like this. But I fell more than I thought I would. No serious injuries, thankfully. That it became tougher probably after I passed the halfway point. Personally for me, those ridges got bigger. I was more tired. It was getting colder. And that's when I feel like it got more difficult personally.
When you're sort of pushing your sledge, for people who don't know what Antarctica's like, what is the sort of feelings around you? What are you sort of experiencing?
You're in, I mean, it's, you know, this white desert, Antarctica, and it's absolutely stunning, but you don't feel like you're skiing towards anything. So you do a 360 and you can't see, you know, anything that you're going towards. And even though I know I'm going towards the South Pole, I can't see the South Pole, which that was kind of mentally difficult. And it's not really smooth. There's all these kind of ridges in places. Some aren't so big, some are really big, and they're basically shaped by the wind out there. There were one or two days where it was calm and it was just unbelievable. It was amazing, like no wind at all. And I take my hood down, I'd be like, wow, it's just, and there's 24 hour daylight, you know, so night and day looks exactly the same. There's absolutely no change whatsoever. Mainly it was windy though, so generally I could just hear wind a lot of the time, and it was always headwind no matter how much I prayed for it to be coming behind me. And one of the messages inside my tent said, remember to enjoy it, which was really important because, you know, you think, of course you're going to enjoy it, you're in this incredible place. But when it was getting tough, it was really hard to remind myself that, you know, actually I'm in Antarctica, this is incredible. And getting to this point is amazing. When the sun was out, it was really lovely. Even though it was windy, I could use my... I could kind of use the sun to navigate as well, which helped. And, you know, kind of look, see my shadow, which it's a small thing, but it's a visual thing. Whereas just because it was 24 hour daylight, the sun wasn't always out. So sometimes it would be cloudy. And sometimes it would be a whiteout, which somebody else had said that a whiteout is like traveling in a marshmallow, which I think is a good way to look at it. And you just can't see anything at all in front of you. It's just, you know, it's like this deep thick fog, like, and that was quite hard because, you know, you can't see anything now. And I'd just be staring down at my compass and sometimes get a little bit motion sickness because I was just staring down, and I'd try and concentrate on different things, so like, you know, either looking at my skis, and I had audiobooks to help me as well, and I try and you know, be, well, you really are invested in the audiobooks you're listening to, so it's important to pick good ones. And yeah, it's this huge white desert, and you feel like you are, well, I felt, you know, that there wasn't anybody for miles and miles from me. And at points that was the case, but even, you know, I've still been dropped off, just especially when you could see when the sun was out and you could, you know, see quite far and just see, yeah, nobody else, no sign of anybody else. It's pretty incredible to think that. Like, I can't think of any other time where I felt like I'm completely physically alone.
Was there a moment where it sort of all nearly fell apart on the trip? You had 40 days. Were there moments where you questioned yourself or questioned something happened?
I did question myself, but I don't think there was ever a point where I thought, I'm not going to do this. And I think there was in the training, but, you know, it took me 2.5 years to get to that start line. There was absolutely no chance I was giving up in that time. This was like the last leg of the journey. It's like not going over that final hill, you know, to the finish line. So there was nothing that was going to stop this part. But there were some tough moments for sure, as it was getting colder, and I think I was losing weight as well and feeling more tired as I went forward. And those sastrugi I mentioned, so those ridges in some sections, they were huge, and I remember looking in some parts thinking, I don't even know how I'm going to navigate around these, and I did fall in a few. Luckily I didn't hurt myself, so even though I went in, my sled didn't follow me, which is good. Occasionally it came down slightly and I'd have to like pull it out with my arms, but that could be quite frustrating. And I remember just at one point screaming out, and I couldn't even hear my scream because I just heard like the wind, you know, it was like lost in the wind. And it was pretty difficult at points like that, and I just had to break it down and focus on taking literally one foot in front of the other, you know, and really not much past that, because I couldn't focus on anything more than that. It was too difficult. I was getting frustrated, and that wasn't really helping me.
And so towards the end, as you're getting closer to the finishing line, what was the sort of feelings running through your head as you're pushing your sledge towards the South Pole?
I just wanted to get there. I think when I got there, it was relief. I did actually get here. It's relief to see something. And even though I've got my GPS, my compass, you know, I know that I'm getting closer. You can't see anything. So visually, to see something is really special. And to get close to there. But a few days out, I was excited to get finished. I was really craving a Coke. Can of Coke, so looking forward to that can of Coke, which I got when I got to the South Pole, which was which was really, really nice. And just I think it was, you know, the weather, it was pretty cold, like really cold when I was there. And I mean, these are estimates because I didn't have anything with me, but I think around minus 50 with the wind chill, maybe a little bit colder on one or two other days. I was tired. I could feel myself slowing right down. So I think towards the end, the feeling was, you know, almost there, just keep going. You are almost there. And because I had good weather the day that I came in, I could see the weather station about five miles out, which is just incredible, because I could see something. It still took me ages to get there, but I could see something. You know, I was skiing towards this, like, this grey colour that I could see in the distance. And yeah, I had to like check that it was really there. I was like, no, that's definitely something, something in the distance. So that was really exciting.
People who get to the South Pole always talk about the sort of feelings of you've been in this white desert for 40 days. Yeah. And then you get to the South Pole, which is sort of like a building site. Is that how one would describe it?
Yeah, I guess there's so much there. You know, I don't know if I expected there to be like all this stuff there. There's like this huge Antarctic research center, there's a weather station, there's all these different like tents set up. I guess for me, I just I remember it was like 3 in the morning or something, but obviously, you know, it looks the same as the day. And I saw people. It was incredible. And I didn't really know what to do. I was like, hi. And then they kind of showed me like the direction towards the South Pole, and then got there. And it was like, oh, wow, like I'm actually here. I think there was definitely relief. But other than that, just, you know, I messaged my partner really quickly to say that I was there, so he wasn't waiting for my check-in call, which I was doing every 24 hours. And it is a building site. There's so much there all of a sudden, which kind of like, oh, where's this all come from? And it was, for me, I think, you know, I was like, oh my God, as a Punjabi girl from Derby, I got to the South Pole, which I try and remind myself that, because, you know, it almost becomes the not like I've been there now. It's like, oh yeah, I've done that. It was, it was an incredible feeling, but it's not unachievable or this like far away dream or anything like that. I got there. So I do need to remind myself of where I was a few years ago, at a point where, you know, I never ever thought I'd do something like this. It just never was in my ideas. I didn't know anything about it. It wasn't really my world.
And was that sort of important to you, to sort of, because after sort of finished and you came home, sort of worldwide press all over, you know, your story was incredible. And, you know, coming back and sort of seeing all the press and all the coverage from it, how was the sort of feelings with that?
I think it was really amazing to see that some of the reactions to it. And, you know, there were some like really great reactions, some probably a little bit less than that, especially around kind of being a woman of color, some of the comments. So, you know, a lot of the news outlets said, first woman of color to do a solo expedition in Antarctica. And it was great to see all the positive comments. And, you know, when I got back to Chile and I was no longer on airplane mode and I had Wi-Fi, I was going right down the comments. And a lot of the comments I saw on mainstream media were things like, why does it matter? Great story, but ruined by the fact that you mentioned the color of her skin and we are all equal. Now, I think it took me a while to process these things. But to me, equality is not about ignoring our differences. So, you know, I was called British and an army officer, but, you know, nobody picked up or had any issue with those differences at all. It was the colour of my skin or the fact that they'd use the term woman of colour. And for somebody who hasn't always been proud of my background and the colour of my skin, I was so, so proud to be there representing, to show that actually, no matter where we're from, what we look like, we can go and achieve anything. At the end of the day, I was told many, many times that I don't look like a polar explorer, and not necessarily in a horrible or malicious way, but it was still said. And, you know, and if people say things enough times, do you then start to believe it? And I wanted to show that, you know, we can look like anything and go and do anything. And, you know, there's been young girls who've dressed as a polar explorer, you know, over the last few months and sent me those pictures. That is incredible. You know, to show that, you know, you can go and do anything, to see somebody that looks like you is extremely powerful. So getting that message out was really great. And, you know, I've been speaking to, I think I've spoken to 17,000 young people since I've been back. You know, the message I really wanted to get across was, to me, it doesn't matter if you have no interest in adventure or Antarctica, but just that whatever the boundaries are for you, like, no boundary or barrier is too small to overcome. Like, you can overcome them, you know, and you can go and do anything. So, you know, don't let anybody limit you. But also, if you do have great, you know, a big ambition, great. And you can do it, but it does also take work to get there, because I think we so often see this end result, right? We see it on social media, we see, you know, so yes, it you know, it is achievable, but that 2.5 years was hard. So please work hard to get whatever it is you want.
Well, you've sort of laid the foundations for future explorers in every all over the world, hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully.
And so, as you say, you sort of came back to this wave. You probably were on a massive high coming back. You'd finished, you're probably exhausted. You had put 2.5 years into this goal. What was the sort of, and you probably almost are still on that sort of mode through giving your talks. Because I was going to say, like, at the end of all, I've had many, many sort of people, polar explorers, adventurers, and at the end, there's always a feeling of like when you've built yourself up to create, to achieve this goal, what was the sort of feelings when you came back after doing it?
So I don't think I have had any come down, if I'm honest with you, at all. It's been pretty full on. It's been really busy with all the talks, which I just finished on Friday. And I think the thing is, even though, yes, the 2.5 years that went into this, it was, I didn't know anything about the South Pole. I didn't dream, you know, I didn't, when I was younger, it wasn't a dream that I always wanted to do this. I wanted to do something big that would help inspire people. And, you know, on the back of this, I'm setting up this adventure grant for women. I'll be giving the first grant this year. I'm also training for phase two of the expedition. So this was, it was actually not my aim to do this trip. I wanted to do a bigger trip. And my application got declined. Because I still didn't have enough experience, so I created phase one, and that's what I just completed. So
what's phase two?
So I wanted to do a crossing, a solo unsupported crossing, which, you know, if I can get the funding and everything, I'll go as soon as I can, really. And I remember putting my application in when I got back from Greenland, because I knew that I didn't have the experience. So I waited because I thought, well, I've done Greenland now. And it was declined, quite rightly, by Ailey. And I thought, you know, again, I was a bit deflated, like, you know, getting it rejected. And I thought, well, what else can I do? So, you know, I knew that I could go to Antarctica and do this expedition, 700 miles to the South Pole, without having been there before and with the experience that I had so far, or with a little bit more, which I then got. So that's what I did. And so this was, you know, yes, a huge expedition in itself, but also gave me the training and everything I needed to go and do phase two.
Join the likes of Colin Brady and Mike Horn.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I guess for me, it was always that was my goal, you know, as in when I thought about what I wanted to do in Antarctica, that was the goal. So, and as great as this trip was, to be honest, as great as like everything that came out of it was, you know, and it's been, yeah, really kind of inspiring to me, for me to see as well. This was always the trip that I was hoping and aiming to do always over the last 2.5 years.
And so that's what's driving you at the moment to go back.
Yeah, no, I think so. So I've finished the talks. See, I've still got a full-time job. So literally finished talks last week and back into my full-time role this week. So just training around that and yeah, hopefully trying to put in a few more barriers this time. Sorry, barriers is not what I meant to say. A few more boundaries this time, just in terms of for myself. So, you know, what I can do, because I felt very, very busy when I got back and I struggled with it mentally, doing all of those things. And actually I think realized I just needed a break. So giving myself time as well and giving myself a break. And, you know, for me, those boundaries would be involving, okay, well, I can't, you know, this is what I can give. I can't maybe come back and do back-to-back talks for this many months. So just figuring those out as well.
Very nice. Well, it's been absolutely incredible sort of listening to this story. And, you know, as you say, it's an absolute inspiration for so many people all over the world. There's a part of the show where we ask the same 5 questions to each guest each week. Okay. With the first being, what does it mean to have purpose?
What does it mean to have purpose? I think that, how does it mean to have purpose? I think that could be whatever's personal to you. So for me, I want to see how much I can do. I feel like getting to the South Pole, I'm only just now realizing what I'm capable of, you know, and I'm 33. So imagine if you believe in yourself from a younger age. I think to have purpose is to have maybe a drive towards whatever that is. I don't think it's something I've always had. And I think at a time when you don't have it, then, you know, get involved in a lot of different things. That's what I did, whether for me that was joining the Army Reserves, it was trying different subjects at my access course to get into my uni course. So I don't think you need to be hard on yourself if, you know, you don't necessarily know which way you need to go. And also your purpose might change. That's okay as well. So that's something I've definitely learned. Sorry if that roundabout answers the question.
Yeah, of course. What about your favorite quote?
Oh, my favorite quote. I have so many. So I think that's a difficult one. I do think nothing is impossible when you believe in yourself. I do believe that. And, you know, no matter how big, no matter how small, I do believe that we can achieve anything we want when we believe in ourselves, which again is difficult. And I know it's not the easiest thing around, but we can get there.
Very nice. Favorite travel book and why?
Favorite travel book. I used to, when I was younger, I used to get The Lonely Planet for everywhere I was going to, just to like see different, you know, like a little bit about each place that I'm going to. But to be honest with you, I like my audiobooks. And the reason I like these audiobooks that I'm going to mention, I think, is when I was listening to them on the ice and I was super invested in them. So I think for that reason, I'm going to pick these ones. So I listened to a lot of South Asian authors when I was in Antarctica, and I listened to The Good Immigrant, the UK and the US version. I listened to Mindy Kaling, Anita Rani, and I loved having their voices with me for so many different reasons. You know, I wondered if they had ever been to Antarctica before, to anywhere, you know, like that. And that for me is actually quite powerful. So as I'm going forward on my next trips as well, I want to take different voices with me, you know, voices that may not have been to those places before.
Amazing. And why are these adventures important to you?
Why they're important to me? Personally, I wanted to push my own mental and physical boundaries, you know, and that's the truth. I think, yes, I of course I want to inspire people, but I do have that personal drive as well, and see you know, what I'm capable of, but also I want to show others that they are also capable of anything. And I really want to make the outdoors as inclusive as possible. And, you know, I'm seeing, looking into now different things I can do to make that happen. And that an adventure could be anything, you know. An adventure for me is still camping in the garden with my niece, you know. An adventure can be on any scale. And the outdoors for me and those adventures, it's a place without judgment, which I love. And I think it can be so good for your mental health. And I almost want people to, and you know, it's not you have to do these adventures, but almost give people the kind of chance to realize that it is an option for them. You know, this is the outdoors is for everybody. And, you know, I think a lot of people can gain something from it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I was speaking to a friend last week and they want to go on a sort of big adventure. And I said, well, and she said, well, go camping, go walking, take a backpack and go walking. And she's like, oh, you know, camping. And I was like, you know, just go home, walk 10 miles, camp in a field.
Yeah.
Then pick yourself up in the morning, walk 10 miles that way and go camp in a field and then come back. It's 2 days where you're just walking by yourself. You don't have to worry about things.
Exactly.
And then by that, it sort of breaks down. The first time you do it, it's terrifying. Like wherever you are in the world, I think like my first time wild camping was in America and I'd been told all these horror stories about America. And then when I did it, you slowly just sort of build. And now, you know, if you said, oh, well, we're just going to go down there 20 miles and camp, I'd just be like, oh, cool. And then you get to a point and you're like, cool, this looks great. I'll just pitch a tent in the little woodlands or something. And that's sort of anyone's adventure. Anyone can have that. So I couldn't agree with you more in that respect.
It can be anything, right? And yeah, I think so many times people say to me, especially now, oh, I'm going to do this, but it's nowhere. It's not, you know, like anything you did. I'm like, don't compare, like with such, also it took me a long time to get to this point. This wasn't just an idea that I had. Also, you know, adventures, whatever we want it to be, it can be anything, you know. It, you know, for me, it has been a lot of the time pushing outside of my comfort zone. The first time I went camping was pushing outside of my comfort zone. So, you know, it's like I said, again, it's so easy to see the end result and, you know, and rather than how people got to where they are.
Mm. In your lifetime, where is the most memorable place you've been and why?
Well, so Antarctica, yeah, Antarctica was obviously an incredible place. But so, yeah, I was going to say India. Maybe because that's a bit of home to me. So I haven't been in a while now. I've been about 10, 11 times in total. But yeah, it's a little bit of home to me. And I guess even before I started doing adventures or anything like that, it, you know, because I think of being on an adventure as a simple life. And I remember when I'd go back, it would be back to the simple life, you know, which I love. You know, you'd, you know, squat to go to the toilet, you would, you know what I mean, use a generator to, like, you know, wash yourself, like, it just, yeah. So I think probably India, if I'm honest with you, and somewhere that, you know, I want to go back hopefully again soon and see people and also travel, because India is huge and I've not kind of traveled much around. I think there's so many incredible places around the world. Obviously Antarctica is an, you know, amazing place. I think just in terms of, yeah, where kind of my heart is at, probably I'd say India as one of the top places.
Yeah, I sometimes think, you know, sort of wild camping or the most basic form of existence can be some of the most enjoyable times, just out on like a mountain camping with the most insane view or sunset. You sort of look back in such happy memories.
Yeah.
And well, I was going to say, you know, you've got these big plans for the future. How can people follow your story?
Yeah, of course. So everything's Polarpreet, which is something I came up with when I started planning this. So Polarpreet is on Instagram, Facebook, the website, which the website actually does say I'm still in Antarctica. So I need to change the homepage because I am not. But everything's on there. And, you know, I post as much as I can, really. And hopefully try and be as honest as I can about my experiences and how I'm feeling. Which isn't always great. But then I think to myself that if you're feeling a certain way, actually it's good to be honest about it, because there's a lot of people that are probably feeling the same way you are and can relate to that. And, you know, I want to be as honest and real as possible, because, you know, to show that I wasn't always here and we all have these feelings.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Preet, it's been an absolute pleasure to listen to your stories today, and I cannot thank you enough for coming on.
Thanks very much. No, thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Well, we'll be following your journey in the future and for part two.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and don't forget to subscribe and review the podcast if you're listening on Apple. A massive thank you to those who reviewed it. And I hope to see you next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day wherever you are in the world, and happy adventures.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.